This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Since early this summer, we've been covering the blossoming algae crisis along Southwest Florida coast, canals, and rivers. Social media is filled with citizen journalists documenting what they're seeing, hearing, and fearing. There are so many angles to these stories and so many overlapping issues that a chorus of questions surround every discussion. So for the past week, we've asked our listeners for their questions, comments, and proposed solutions, and the response has been overwhelming. We have several pages of questions in 11-point font that we'll try to get through in 1 hour today. So let me quickly introduce who we have to try to answer as many of these questions as possible. First in studio is Rayanne Wessel. We talked just last week. Good to have you back. She's the Natural Resource Policy Director at the Santa Isabel Captiva Conservation Foundation.
Thank you for the invitation.
We are also trying to get a hold of Amy Bennett-Williams. She's an environmental reporter and storyteller for the News Press. She's been covering the issue for years and has a wealth of reporting knowledge on the topic. Amy is just getting off of a boat that was out taking samples of the water. We're trying to get her on the phone to join us. We're also going to talk a little bit about the health effects and symptoms that he's seen with Dr. Patrick Reedy. He's with the Florida Gulf Coast Ear, Nose, and Throat. Dr. Reedy, I really appreciate you rearranging your schedule to make it in today.
Thanks for having me again.
And on the phone from his office in Sarasota, we've got Dr. Vince Lovko. He's the staff scientist and program manager of the phytoplankton ecology program at Moat Marine Laboratory. Dr. Lovko, thanks to you as well.
Thanks for having me on the program today.
If you didn't get a chance to send in your questions, go ahead and give us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU, using the hashtag of GCL. So, Rayanne, you were at a screening last night of a film called Toxic Puzzle at the Broadway Palm Dinner Theater. How was the turnout and panel discussion after that? I just want to ask you real quick, because the response we got to just give us your questions was pretty overwhelming.
This is an overwhelming event because it affects everybody in one way or another. So the event was sold out last night at the Broadway Palm Dinner Theater that Representative Fitzenhagen hosted, a screening of a environmental, medical detective story trying to figure out what are the connections between cyanobacteria toxins and neuromuscular disease. And they found some very interesting connections, and I think there's some very good science behind it. So there was an enormous number. I was moderating the discussion, and we kind of had to do a lightning round to try to get through all the questions with the scientists. But I think it was very educational and very value added because the scientists could bring their research into the discussion.
I think it's really interesting how the response has been to all of this. There are people that have a whole lot of questions. And a lot of the questions I know we've answered on the show before, but they keep coming up because people are kind of new into the conversation. So we're going to try to get to those throughout the day today. We arranged them thematically. Some wondered about the overarching questions. Some want to know specifically about the Everglades agricultural area and how sugar is connected to all this. We have questions about tracking nutrients and the science behind it. Others are asking about economic repercussions and who's liable. There are many people wondering about health impacts. There are also comments about politics and several proposed solutions. So I want to get started, but it looks like we do have Amy Bennett-Williams on the phone. Amy, are you there?
I am. Hi.
I'm so glad you're able to join us. Tell me about what you saw this morning.
Well, this morning I went out with Calusa waterkeeper John Cassani and James Metcalf, one of the scientists who was at the event last night, and we were sampling Dr. Metcalf was gathering up the cyanobacteria, and in some places it's still really thick. It's not in those big ganache-like curds that it was a couple of weeks ago, but you can see it suspended throughout the water column in all of the places we were on the river. So he's collecting that, putting it in test tubes, and then is going to see what the concentration is and which toxins he collected today.
So he's just kind of taking the temperature, so to speak.
Yes. But this will be useful for their ongoing research into BMAA, and then it'll also help us know what we've got here.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm going to dive into these questions. Rayanne, this one is one that I think you'd be most equipped or well-equipped to handle here. When did they first change the flow of the water from Lake O? What happened to get us to where we're at right now?
So the outflow was changed in 1880s when Hamilton Diston connected the Caloosahatchee and the Western Everglades to Lake Okeechobee. Prior to that, there was an old Miami Indian Canal, but it only came into the Western Everglades, which was like an Everglades system, and it was perched 4 to 10 feet above the Western Caloosahatchee Valley. So the river really started at a waterfall just east of LaBelle.
And then what people are looking at is the history of why things were changed, and they are looking at that change because people are wanting to make a connection between human activity and what's happening with red tide, and if blue-green algae has an impact on that, if they happen to correlate with one another. What have you seen so far, Ann?
So it's really clear that the nutrients that we have added into the aquatic system have driven and are the common denominator with both the blue-green algae and the red tide to some extent. They are two very distinct events. One is a fresh cyanobacteria bloom, freshwater cyanobacteria bloom, and the other is a marine red tide. So both of these organisms have existed on the planet, but to describe anything about what is happening as natural, which is unfortunately the way it's been characterized by some, is not at all accurate. So everything that we do, whether it's fertilizers in our backyard or from agriculture, whether it's chemicals, whether it's reuse water that has a very high nutrient signature, whether it's septic tanks, pet waste, whatever it is, and then the whole suite of environmental regulations that don't protect water quality anymore, they've been rolled back or they're inadequate standards. All of that contributes. So I think we have to recognize we all play a role in that.
Amy Bennett-Williams, I'm going to turn to you now. The next question that we had is septic tank runoff part of the problem? Rhianne Wessel just indicated that's one of the things. Can you tell me a little bit about septic tank runoff as it contributes to the problem, and then what other things are part of this equation as far as polluting things?
Well, sure. Well, I really, the word runoff, when you think about it, is kind of horrifying. I think it's more like seepage. If a septic tank were to be so broken that its fluids were running across the surface into water bodies, that would be really nasty. But when septic tanks age and their drain fields age, sometimes they don't drain as well as they're supposed to and they don't process the nutrients. And when there are heavy rains, that stuff that's in the soil can wash into the tributaries and the rivers and eventually to the Gulf, and that can definitely be part of the problem. However, it's the majority of households are on municipal systems, and while there definitely are septic tanks in use, my house has one. I don't think that the scientists I've talked to think that that is a huge contributor to the problem, but they're looking at signals that mark human waste, certain artificial sweeteners, for example, that animals and pets don't characteristically consume. And so they're looking at how much of that they can find in these polluted areas. Correct me if I'm wrong, Rayanne, and to just try to get some handle on what the contribution of human waste, and especially delivered via faulty septic systems, is.
And I would agree with that assessment. One of the more pressing issues that's not being looked at with septic systems, which is probably one of the smaller contributors, is the fact that sea level rise is raising water tables, and some of the older septic systems don't have that 2-foot separation between the bottom of the drain field and the high water table so that it can actually work, because septic systems are designed to work very well, just not in high density and not close to water bodies and high water tables.
There are a lot of things about sea level rise that people kind of don't really look at as far as the water table rising along with it. I wanted to ask the relationship between – this is the next question from somebody. What is the relationship between red tide and blue-green algae bloom with discharges from Lake Okeechobee into the Caloosahatchee River? Many of these questions may sound very similar, but I want to direct this one to Dr. Vince Lovko, because I'd like to know, Dr. Lovko, if there is a correlation that's been drawn scientifically. Anecdotally, it seems like they coincide. I want to know what kind of science is behind that.
Sure. So the cause-effect relationship between freshwater cyanobacterial blooms and excess nutrient input into primarily freshwater bodies is pretty clear and well-established. Similar events occur around the world and certainly around this country. The source of nutrients that can be somewhat difficult to pinpoint and can be diverse and somewhat variable. The link between the nutrification of freshwater bodies and such as Lake Okeechobee and red tide is a little less distinct. And that's partly because we don't. So one thing that's important to remember is why we have algal blooms in coastal waters. These areas tend to be very productive, some, of course, more than others. But what that means is that there's an abundance of life, and this life begins with phytoplankton, which are the base of the food chain, of course. So the reason that phytoplankton are in these coastal areas is because of the land-derived nutrient input into the coastal waters. And that, of course, is a normal thing and is important and feeds the food chain. Of course, excess nutrient input can disrupt that ecosystem. And worldwide, it's generally thought that this nutrification of coastal systems is part of the cause to the worldwide increase in algal blooms. But algal blooms are the factor of the biology, the particular bloom-forming species that you have in a particular area, also the local conditions and geography where it blooms. And so here on the west coast of Florida, our rivers empty primarily into bays and estuaries before coming out to the coast. So there's a lot of organisms in these bays and estuaries that can utilize those nutrients. So one of the things that we don't have a clear handle on is how much of those nutrients, either naturally occurring or human-enhanced, actually make it out of the bays and estuaries and into these coastal systems where red tide can use those nutrients. And, you know, that's a question that just isn't fully answered. You know, we're certainly not trying to indicate that cannot exacerbate the blooms, but that link is a little less clearly defined than the link with the freshwater cyanobacterial blooms.
Are you studying that currently?
Are we studying? Well, yeah. So as far as the red tide goes and the nutrient input, I mean, we've collected, you know, we have decades of data, but unfortunately, you know, the data are often, you know, little pinpoint snapshots in a period of time when we go out and collect samples. And, you know, one of the things that's really needed is a more comprehensive and thorough assessment of some of the parameters that we need to measure. For example, you know, to look at the Caloosahatchee input, I mean, a transect from the mouth of the Caloosahatchee out to the coastal system, sampling that transect, you know, over a period of time, both before, during, and after releases from the Caloosahatchee would help to answer that question. That's something that's simply not in place right now.
And here's another question. This is from this one was repeated a couple times, and I think this might also be one that Dr. Lefko would be best to answer. Could the BP oil spill residue on the Gulf bottom be contributing to this situation?
I don't think there's any evidence of that. You know, one thing that's important to remember is we do have these blooms periodically. This current bloom certainly is one of the worst ones we've had, at least since the 2004-6 bloom. There have been periodic, very long-lasting and intense blooms. To my knowledge, there's no evidence to link those two events.
All right, and I'm going to turn back to Amy Bennett-Williams. The next question from a listener is algae being removed from local waters yet? What is Lee County using all the emergency money coming from the state for?
The emergency money is distributed through a couple of mechanisms. And the first set of state of emergency money is going to be made available to businesses that can show that they've been harmed by this crisis. But that was for red tide. And then the second state of emergency is going to be distributed, and I think some of it is going for cleanup. Yes, I believe that the county has begun taking some of this algae out of the dead-end canals and the places where it's the most concentrated. The question that I am actually about to write the county and ask is where exactly they are going to put it, because it's very wet. Are they going to store it? There was some talk about injecting it in deep, you know, into deep wells. Is it going to a landfill? Would it be incinerated? I think the people to whom I've spoken are pretty sure that it's going to a landfill somewhere, but I want to pin that down, and I will.
All right, and I want to turn now to Rayanne Wessel for the next question. Why do they not clean the algae from the top of Lake O before sending it to us?
So the cyanobacteria blooms that we're having in the lake, the freshwater blooms, occur throughout the water column. So the
they're not just all on the top. You can't just take a skimmer.
Right. Well, that's what's being done with this cleanup. And that's one way of at least getting the worst and most offensive and oldest and most toxic releasing form of the algae out of the water. So it's helpful in that regard, and it's removing the organic load. But the particular cyanobacteria we're talking about have a buoyancy compensation. They can move up and down depending on all kinds of features. So even in these canals where the water is being cleaned, there's still a lot of organic and biological algae in the water. Now, that said, the design of the locks that are connecting Lake Okeechobee and down the Caloosahatchee, all those gates open from the bottom. So the idea was that you would get rid of you'd save the best water for the water supply, which Lake Okeechobee – I mean the county of Okeechobee takes their water supply from Lake Okeechobee from the surface. So yeah, that's a whole nother issue.
Wow. So and the next question I'm going to ask is, how is it possible that just a short time ago we were issued watering restrictions due to a drought, and now there's suddenly so much water that the Army Corps of Engineers has created this disaster? I'm going to give that one to you, Rayanne Wessel, about this is kind of like that tightrope we've talked about many times that we are walking with the water situation in Florida.
And Florida just has the pattern of turning the water on and turning the water off. We have some very distinct wet and dry seasons. Those are getting a little bit more diffuse because of climate changes that are changing our weather patterns a little bit. But there is a very good kernel in that question, and that is that from January until it started raining in May, we needed additional water from Lake Okeechobee to manage that salinity balance downstream of the Franklin Lock. We have a dependence on that system because we have rising seas, we have a hard constructed lock at the estuary boundary, and so if we don't get enough water, if you have a dry season or a drought, and there's not rain coming in, there's nothing to keep that sea level rise from pushing up against the lock and compressing and eliminating the upper estuary's freshwater condition. So we need water from the lake during the dry season. However, water managers frequently, if not almost every year, decide to cut back or eliminate discharges to the Caloosahatchee. And as a result, the lake is held higher. This year, because we didn't release that water, they were cutting us back. We had water shortages in the river. The lake ended up a little higher than it should have been, and that was entirely a policy decision.
All right, I'm going to shift this next question to Dr. Lovko at Moat Marine. If the red tide and blue-green algae cleared up tomorrow, how long would the ecosystem feel the effects? The birds, the turtles, the fish, the shellfish, the marine mammals, how long would the toxins remain in their bodies, and will they be passed to their young?
That's an excellent question, and of course a difficult one to answer. if all of it was to end and disappear tomorrow, we would probably still see some effects. As far as the ecological effects, as I'm sure everybody listening is aware, there has been pretty massive mortalities of many marine animals, especially fish. How long it would take those populations to recover, I'm not quite sure. As far as the lingering effects of toxins, a lot of the toxin retention in some of our commercial shellfish, such as edible clams and oysters, is pretty well known. But what isn't known is the retention in some of the other filter feeding organisms, other types of mollusks and bivalves, and a lot of those are prey for other organisms such as crabs and whelks and things like that. So as far as how long that toxin would retain in the overall ecosystem, it would probably go on for quite a while. Sorry, I can't give you a more definitive answer than that, but there's a lot of variables to consider.
What is in the water? And I know that your research is mainly the red tide just itself. What happens after red tide goes away? Is it decomposed? Does it turn into something else?
So the red tide, you know, it's an organism, a dinoflagellate. It's part of the phytoplankton community. And so there is a phytoplankton community that's out there. There are many different types of phytoplankton, different taxa, and many different species. And Karenia is a background part of this. It's pretty much always present. If you look at enough water, even during a time of no blooms, you're going to eventually find a Karenia brevis cell. So, of course, during a bloom, it's able to outcompete its fellow phytoplankton. After a bloom, one of the things that my group specifically is looking at is what happens to this phytoplankton community. As I mentioned before, the phytoplankton, of course, are a very critical link in the food chain. They're the base of it, especially in aquatic systems, coastal systems especially. If you disturb that phytoplankton community, you could have a disturbance to the ecology as well. So one of the things, there's two kind of veins that we're looking at. One is what the effect of Karenia brevis, especially massive blooms like this, is on the phytoplankton community and how quickly it recovers. And also, can we see changes in the phytoplankton community that could let us know a bloom is on its way? So whatever environmental factors are changing to allow a Karenia bloom to dominate should also affect the rest of the phytoplankton community. In fact, it could be some of those effects on the phytoplankton community that allows Karenia brevis to dominate.
And I'm going to shift now to a different topic, and it's going to be about health. I think a lot of people have concerns about the health impacts on humans. We've seen in numerous photos the impacts it's had on marine life, but we are wondering about human life at this point. And I wanted to ask Amy Bennett-Williams, have you had any luck getting any information out of authorities regarding the impacts of red tide or even blue-green algae toxins on human health systems?
Well, it's been an ongoing struggle. It's easier for health people to talk about acute effects. I mean, red tide is very obviously, there's the respiratory distress, the wheezing, the coughing, the sneezing, the headachey stuff. And people who hang out close to the blue-green algae blooms have reported similar symptoms as well as dizziness and lightheadedness. I asked Lee Health for their numbers. They have diagnostic codes, and it's very few. I mean, no more than a handful since this event began. I asked since November. But I think also that people aren't necessarily connecting their exposure. I mean, you know, so many people live with the water and near the water, and they may have, you know, some problem and not necessarily think, oh, you know, maybe it's because I was breathing aerosolized algae. I have been in communication with the Poison Control Center, and they are going to send me the number of calls that they have had, both about red tide and blue-green algae. And again, these are acute problems, you know, just when you're feeling bad. What is much less known about is what the potential long-term effects of exposure both to red tide and the cyanobacteria and its toxins as well. There are a number of studies that are quite frightening. The event last night spoke about one of these, BMAA, and its influence in neurodegenerative diseases, but there's extreme liver toxicity that's been tied to some of these blue-green algae toxins and, you know, all sorts of nasty stuff. The science is ongoing. Funding is always an issue. But, yeah, I think that there are definitely potential long-term health impacts that we are scrambling to learn about.
And I'm going to turn now to Dr. Reedy, sitting in studio nodding over here. Have you seen people coming in complaining about the effects of these toxins and breathing them?
Sure. We're seeing a lot of problems regarding the red tide especially. So more commonly, as she said, you're going to see the red tide symptoms. They will bother pretty much anybody, but people who are sensitive, especially asthmatics, people with underlying pulmonary issues are really sick right now, some of them. Because it's a toxin, it's not like treating allergies. It's very difficult to treat because it's not an allergic reaction. It is a toxic reaction.
You know, I keep hearing about people who have asthma or other respiratory issues having a harder time with it. I have no real respiratory issues, and I was near that stuff, and it was really bad for a full day. I feel like, I mean, I understand it's even worse for people who already
Correct.
Have pre-existing situations. But everything that I'm hearing as far as like the news releases and information that I get out of officials from the state, they want to point mainly to persons who already have problems rather than everyday persons who you know, are breathing this in and feeling the impacts for at least a day.
Sure. So the issue is that there are some known basic symptoms that almost everybody would experience, and that's where these toxins are an irritant. And they're
like a mild pepper spray.
You got it. So they're an irritant to mucosal surfaces, your eyes, your throat, your nose, your lungs. And for most people, it is irritating, all right? But there's a difference in being irritated significantly. I'm coughing. I can't catch my breath just because I'm coughing a lot. My eyes are burning. Even your skin, it can have some cutaneous reactions. There's a difference between that and it's actually causing pulmonary changes, which, you know, your lung function is decreasing.
What happens with a person, though, that already has a problem, has a breathing issue? They already have a problem. What's happening in them when this toxin gets into their system?
So it will stimulate the irritation. And basically in somebody who has most of these things, asthma, we call a hyperreactive airway disease. It just triggers, set it off. And this is a trigger. It's a difficult trigger to make better because, again, if you follow an allergy, we know the pathway of the allergy. If I give this medicine, or this medicine, then it's going to reverse the specifics of what's stimulating that hyperreaction. In this case, it's a toxin. The toxin can bind to things, and until it simply gets off of that stuff, it will continue to stimulate the reaction. So in an allergic situation or something like that, steroids are your biggest gun or your nuclear bomb to wipe it out. But here, steroids are less effective because it's not such an inflammatory condition. It's stimulating the toxin. It's having direct effects itself. And unless you can remove the toxin, it is very hard to make people better.
How do you remove a toxin?
Oftentimes time. Yeah, time. If you don't have a specific antidote, time.
Yeah.
Most things will only bind to something for so long, or cell death will, a new cell won't, you know, be affected by it, but a lot of it is time.
I'm wondering, as a doctor, when things like this are going on, do you get like an update from the ENTs of Florida saying these are ways to go about handling these kinds of things? I mean, is there like an insider discussion about?
I wouldn't say probably insider discussions a little much, but they have sent some articles that, you know, you will see patients with this. Usually what they're doing is maybe sending a link to a study that shows what's going on or other people's thoughts and just to remind us that you're going to see this. But unfortunately, no, there's not any kind of direct, I would say, education or warning. Or it's if you're looking at your little, you know, email updates on ENT news or allergy news, then little links will come through regarding this and what's going on.
Well, I'm sure you're not the only ENT that's been dealing with patients.
Any ENT allergist. And that's for the red tie. And certainly emergency rooms, urgent cares are going to see a lot of it. For the cyanobacteria, most of those symptoms would probably be more prone to show up at an urgent care, ER, primary care doctor.
We're talking blue-green here.
Blue-green here, which is okay. Totally different.
Yeah.
In this case, most people are going to experience these short-term exposures, but these are serious toxins. Once you start talking these cyanobacteria, she was saying, these are deadly neurotoxins. And there's no joke. If you look at what these are bad. And you look even the general class of the toxins, alkaloids, lipopolysaccharides, microcystins, anatoxins. These are some of the most deadly poisons that you could possibly find.
And they're floating around right now.
Correct. And for us, this is a little bit of a newer experience, but this is a worldwide problem. So the truth is you can find a lot of research about human exposure to these things if you look at research done in China, Africa, Central America, South Asia.
I found some in Ohio. I found some studies coming out of Ohio.
Correct. So there are a couple more local things where cyanobacteria blooms were definitely linked to people getting sick. Now, for short-term exposures, most of these people would present, just like she said, mostly GI disturbance. So most of these neurotoxins and low-dose exposure will cause GI symptoms, upset stomach, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea. They are well-known hepatotoxins, and increasing doses are, again, for somebody who's already sensitive, you know, has an underlying hepatitis A or C or some sort of chronic liver disease already, they could certainly affect those people more. And more often than not, as she said, you'll see more of the acute things for human beings. Animals, there's lots of studies that will show how deadly it is to animals. Your cat goes out there and drinks that, or your dog, it could easily kill them, you know, quickly. Even cattle, lots of studies on cattle that drink from ponds or lakes. Again, a lot of the cyanobacteria is more freshwater, will have problems. But the studies, if you look in China, they can directly link this, as she said, to chronic health conditions as well. One of the more famous ones was a link between this and diabetes, where they found in a unique area of China a people that have a cluster of diabetes that was otherwise unexplainable for most people living in rural China, where they tend to eat, you know, fairly healthy. And they realized that people were also having these health effects twice a year when there were these blue-green algae blooms in this particular lake. And when they started studying the toxin that came up, they found that this toxin was in fact causing huge insulin problems in these people. Hyperinsulinemia, it was causing insulin resistance and having direct effects on the pancreatic system to in fact be the causative factor. They proved it conclusively in these individuals.
And then I want to ask – I got another question that just came in over Facebook. One says, does he think that people working to pick up dead fish should be better protecting themselves? Because there we're talking about just straight up bacteria of rotting marine life.
Correct. So you should definitely be wearing gloves and probably long sleeves, long pants. So the fish on their skin can contain both toxins, either the red tide or the cyanobacterias, which again can directly act on your skin, especially some of these toxins from the cyanobacteria are definitely known to cause dermatologic problems and sometimes severe. I couldn't find any as severe as we're seeing some reports of the weed up in New England area causing these severe burns of the skin, but pretty severe dermatitis as a result. Similarly, animals who would eat any of that stuff, especially the skin of any of these animals, you know, certainly have a problem. So I would definitely cover myself. And if you are sensitive, wear a mask.
Yeah. Would you go out to the beach right now?
I have not in this area for a while now. We spend a lot of time in the summer in the waters, and it simply has not been good.
There was another question that came in from Tia Singer Willen. She says, my husband died at 39 from a BMAA-associated disease, lifelong Cape Coral resident, avid fisherman, my best friend, USN vet, LCSO sergeant. Watching him suffer for years was the most horrific experience I and my four kids had. What is being done to prevent more deaths? That's a tough one. I'll ask Rayanne Wessel, what are you seeing that's being done?
Well, one of the interesting things about this documentary that was screened last night, The Toxic Puzzle, was showing that these cyanobacteria toxins can have long-term impacts. So as Dr. Larry Brand from University of Miami said last night, red tide is a handier toxin because you get that irritation right away. You know you're being attacked, whereas cyanobacteria toxins, I mean, it might be nasty in a closed end of a canal, but they are in the fish, they are in the shellfish, they are in all kinds of organisms. So you don't taste them, you don't smell them until they're contained, and you can be exposed for a long period of time before you recognize. And the long-term kind of chronic effects, perhaps one of the ones that she mentioned, is not going to show up for a couple decades. And that's devastating because then you can't even protect yourself. Protection-wise, I'm not sure that other than bringing this information to light, and I think this is why we've been so alarmed that the Department of Health, the state doesn't have a dedicated point agency responsible for making the public aware. It's been up to people like myself and others to call around and say, by the way, you really should post these kinds of warnings. The other thing that we've encouraged the state to do is become part of the cyanobacterial to set cyanobacterial standards, and EPA has 22 states that have established standards. So we wouldn't be breaking new ground.
Florida has no standards as far
Florida
as –
Florida is the largest shoreline, recreational shoreline in the lower 48, and we have none.
And we also used to have an active harmful algal blooms task force that was since – defunded, but that's one of the solutions that most of the experts to whom I've spoken said, if we just had a dedicated group that met regularly, shared information, and then shared what they were seeing with the public aggressively, that would be a huge step forward as well.
And I'm going to ask Dr. Lovko one quick question. It's a very easy, simple, quick one, although there's probably not an easy, simple, quick answer, but how long are we looking at this red tide continuing to linger and this problem sticking around?
You're right. That's not a simple answer. But I'll give one as best as I can. So we have what we used to consider, or what we still often consider, to be a red tide season, that where we see them. If we're going to see a bloom, we often see the expression of it on the surface near the coast by September, certainly by early October. tends to last through the winter and into maybe March when it dissipates. That's of course changed over the years as well. There seems to be kind of a shifting more towards spring. This bloom this year started late. We first got indication of it in late October, and it was a full-fledged bloom in November, and of course is continuing now and hasn't really had a real break. So based on that schedule I said before, then we're coming upon what would be the next bloom season. So during a bloom season, quote-unquote, we would expect to have the conditions that are conducive to a bloom sticking around. So if this one makes it until September, is it going to stick around? On top of that, is another bloom initiating now that might add to this bloom? Those are questions that we currently don't have answers to. So as far as prediction and forecasting, that's very embryonic right now in the harmful algal bloom field as a whole, and certainly a direction that the entire field is trying to move to get better at being able to predict and forecast blooms. Currently, University of South Florida has a couple of tools that they use. One is a forecasting tool that's primarily based on the movements of the loop current in the Gulf of Mexico, and it's clear that there's more than the loop current that is a factor in the creation of blooms. And then the other is a bloom movement model. It's a 3.5-day forecast that when we have a bloom, it basically, using the current models, the water movement models, it'll determine where that bloom is going to go. But as far as predicting how long this bloom is going to last or if it's going to carry on into the next bloom season, it's difficult to say.
And I'm going to have another question about health-related things real quick. There are two questions that came in on Facebook. One says, how is the hazardous waste from cleanup of fish kill, larger dead carcasses, and blue-green algae being handled and disposed? Are there measures being taken to prevent further pollution and contamination, particularly of groundwater and aquifer from this waste? And Barbara Hill is asking on Facebook, the Florida aquifer provides our drinking water, and it seems to me this underground system is interconnected. So are the chemical industries, such as phosphate and Bone Valley, adding to this toxic algae crisis in this extended red tide bloom? These two questions I'm going to ask real quick, Amy Bennett-Williams, and have you address, I think you talked a little bit about how you're trying to figure out where the blue-green algae is being disposed of. Do you know where they're taking the fish kill and the large dead carcasses that they're taking off the beaches?
For sure, some of them. I don't know everything about all of them because I have seen some carcasses put into trucks and presumably carried somewhere. But the really large creatures, the 200 and 300 pound sea turtles, the whale shark, remember the big whale shark that mm-hmm. died and washed up on Sanibel? They are burying those on site just a little bit up the beach. They bring in big, heavy equipment and dig trenches and roll the critters in and cover them up. And so they're there. I think that they're also using, bulldozer, front-end loader type stuff to sort of scoop the mass of fish together into one pile. And I think they're burying those as well.
Man, I can just see some overzealous golden retrievers getting into that.
Oh, my goodness, yeah. And imagine, future archaeologists.
Oh, yeah.
Finding all these out-of-context bones. But, yeah, for sure, the big animals, they can't really do anything with them but bury them on site. I know manatees are taken to a lab and necropsied, but the other stuff, the sea turtles, the whale shark, they're right there. They're right on the beach.
Rayanne, I'm going to ask you a little bit about the aquifer, about our drinking water. Is it safe?
That is a good question. We don't have any evidence to the contrary in terms of cyanobacteria or any algae related. And majority of people get their drinking water from the aquifer. The question is if you're getting your water from a surface water source. So whether that's Lake Okeechobee in the county of Okeechobee or
have they had that water tested that they're drinking over there?
Sure. And what they can do is they can take, and you mentioned it. Ohio. So Lake Erie has had an ongoing challenge with water quality, and part of what that movie documentary last night was highlighting is the fact that you can take in water, and Sandusky was highlighted. They take in the water. They can see the cyanobacteria in the water. They clean it. They can document that the finished water, because these are surface water sources, that the surface water, the finished water is clean of toxins. They get a clean test. But the question that was raised is they are not testing for this amino acid BMAA, which is the culprit in these neurodegenerative
long-term
diseases.
Illnesses.
And so that's there's no standards, there's no test, and that's not being tested for. But they can remove the toxins.
All right. We have a caller on the line. This is Linda in Fort Myers. Linda, what would you like to ask?
Hey, great program. 5 minutes ago, one of your speakers used the word defunded. And it was quickly, and I didn't, what was defunded and by whom or by what agency and why?
I'm going to direct that question to Amy Bennett Williams, because I know that you've covered this for a number of years and you've looked at the legislature and the state government as far as its impacts on the EPA and defunding the harmful algal bloom thing. I think that was actually your comment that she's referring to.
Yes, it was a state harmful algal blooms task force. I think that's what it was. Rayanne, help me with this. Was it a task force? Okay. And it still exists on paper, but I think essentially what happened is there was no money in the state budget set aside for it. So as all of these items, every year the legislatures decide how much DCF is going to get and how much the Florida Department of Environmental Protection is going to get. And this was one of those things that was operating for a while. And I think it was 2010, but don't trust me on that. There just was no money set aside for it in the budget that year, and it has not operated ever since.
I'm going to shift now to some of the finger pointing that we're having a lot of. Here's a question that says, can you tell me what this and also the history and land acquisition south of Lake O? This person is saying, can you tell me what the status is of the land acquisition south of Lake O? I believe it was a very large chunk of land just south of the lake that the state was going to buy from Big Sugar, maybe 2007, ? It fell through because of the recession. Why can't we fire that up again? Rayanne, can you answer that one for me?
So, yes, indeed, the then governor of the state of Florida, Charlie Crist, and U.S. Sugar got together in 2007 and to resolve some issues. The suggestion was made that maybe for the first time in 70 years, we'd look at buying out U.S. Sugar. They offered, and we would purchase 187,000 acres. We would own the entire network, whether it was canals or railroads or buildings. The problem is the recession came on and conditions deteriorated and there wasn't money. The proposal got renegotiated four times, and we did end up buying two parcels of land for about 27,000 acres. Those were immediately put into work in cleaning water in the EAA.
Letting water slowly flow over it so that it can take out some of these nutrients and then let the water go on down.
Yes. Right, treatment marshes. So fast forward to today, we have a much better economy, but U.S. Sugar is no longer willing to sell. So we have a negotiated – so that land deal was really put on hold and is just timing out.
So they offered it up. We couldn't afford to buy it, so we didn't buy it. Now the offer is no longer on the table.
We only got a little chunk. Pieces, and we had I think four different options to close on certain designated tranches of land. But the legislature and the water management district did not support moving forward with that. And I think the landowners really were no longer that interested. Conditions had recovered. But the good news is that in last year's legislative session, the Senate Bill 10 – that's known as the EAA Reservoir Bill that was fostered by Senate President Negron, did go through the process and finally negotiated to establish 10,000 acres for a reservoir for 270,000 acre feet and 6,500 acres for one of those filter marshes to treat the water. So that was already state-owned land because there was no willing seller, and the bill – to get passed had to have the agreement that they would not use eminent domain.
There are a couple questions about eminent domain, like why can't we just do that? Here's a question from someone that says, why can't we just release Lake O water onto the sugar farms?
Well,
just let it fly.
So this is a conversation that we've been having. Number one, that's private property, and there are operation schedules for how we move water and where we move it. But one of the opportunities, since the landowners have not been willing to sell land, additional land, the idea is moving into a conversation about what we call maybe dispersed water management.
Like bypassing the owned land, the private property?
Nope. You actually engage the landowner to farm water. You actually pay them. They're not willing to sell the land. We have to go through these contortions to move water in places that we don't want it. So why not turn that around and say, all right, you continue to own the land, but let's have a new crop. Let's have water.
Clean water crop.
What is the Everglades about if not water? And that would expand the opportunities for water treatment, storage, and for the Everglades.
And this is a bit of a conversation that this guy put it pretty succinctly. It says, I hope you address larger issues surrounding water quality and quantity flow, i.e. Florida population growth. We all influence changes in our environment, not just agriculture. Orlando area with practically direct channel into Lake O via Kissimmee River until it's reverted. Septic tanks and homeowner impact, 65% to 80% of nutrient load is from local area basin. Farmers use best management practices and are original stewards of the land. Livelihood depends on it. Do homeowners? Farmers may follow the 4R principle. Use the right product in the right amount in the right place at the right time if needed. Do homeowners? And these larger components apply to water quantity, too. Again, population. What is the statistic? 60% of Florida used to be underwater, but now all of us people have changed the land. Army Corps has its challenges to manage flow all the while without knowing what the weather will do. The 40,000 residents directly south of the lake are at greatest risk of dike breaches, but we also know the risk of excess water on coastal pavement, too. There is a bigger narrative than what I hear a lot of. Yes, I work in agriculture. I live inland, but I fished the Gulf on Saturday. This is not us versus them or me versus you. We have all changed the environment. Fingers cannot point to only one potential source. So we're getting a lot of inland versus coast in a lot of the narrative that's happening. So I want to, I guess, leave it open. Who wants to jump in on that and talk about maybe a cumulative responsibility?
I'll be glad to. We all have to pull together. We're sitting on the same peninsula. And it's true, when you point a finger, there are usually three fingers pointing back at you. So I don't think anybody is held harmless in this scenario. Growth has been a huge part of the changes that have occurred to this state. I think we should have been called the wetland state instead of the sunshine state. But notwithstanding that information, we have to figure out better ways to come to some resolution on how to manage both water supply for our water needs, water flood control for protection of property and health, and natural system resiliency. Because if you move here for fishing and the water, it doesn't have the same allure when everything's dead. I will say this, that we have best management practices that apply to agriculture. We have a different set of rules that apply to urban environments.
And golf courses.
In the Caloosahatchee, we have – the Water Management District has documented that the majority of the nutrient inflow is coming from upstream of the Franklin Lock. Most of our urban development is downstream. We have much stricter controls on surface water management. What people think of as their development ponds are actually water treatment features. By contrast, in agriculture, they have an opportunity to sign up for a best management practice. That is an agreement that gives them a presumption of compliance with water quality. It's not the same as holding water on your land. It's not the same as treating water to a certain standard and facing a consequence if you don't meet that standard. Additionally, south of the lake, the big challenge is that those agricultural fields are using the inventory, the infrastructure of the Everglades that was taxpayer funded to treat Lake O water. They use it for their runoff and discharge. About 80% of that capacity is being used by agriculture. So maybe there's a middle ground. What if agriculture had to manage water, stormwater on their own property before they shunted untreated off into public infrastructure and public waterways.
That actually addressed another question. We are running low on time, so I'm going to try to motor through. We have Scott on the line from Bukelia. You have a question, Scott?
Yes. It seems like the red tide outbreak has been centered around Boca Grande. It's moved a little up and down, but really that's the epicenter of the thing. And I wonder if it could be because of something coming downstream from the Peace River, like runoff from the phosphate mining operation up there.
All right, Scott, I'm going to direct your question to Dr. Lovko. Is there any possibility of phosphate mining feeding into this?
Well, generally, most of our coastal system tends to be more nitrogen limited. You need a certain balance of nitrogen and phosphorus in order to allow phytoplankton to bloom. So I don't know. I haven't measured the phosphates coming out of Boca Grande. I will say that this bloom did start back in October, and the initial count seemed to be centered around the Venice area, and then it did start to spread, and it did kind of spread down south. It did seem to be like Venice down to probably around Sanibel seemed to be the area that always had some red tide as the red tide itself was moving up and down the coast. But again, you know, it's important to remember that right now we have it spreading from, there have been some counts detected in Pinellas County and counts all the way down south as far as Collier County. So we have roughly, 120 to 150 mile long bloom. So whatever the influences have been at various points, it's probably not the same influences along the entire bloom.
And I'm going to go back to Lake O and talk with Amy Bennett-Williams here and say, these are two questions, and they're about back pumping. How can any back pumping into Lake O by agricultural interests be regulated? I understand that the Corps has to protect private property. However, nutrient-laden water should be cleaned before introduced into the lake. How much of the water in the lake comes from such back pumping? And another question said, why is the polluted water from the cane fields and farmlands pumped into Lake O? Why is it not just left to flow south into the Everglades? Amy, do you have an answer to any of that about back pumping?
The first thing I'm going to do is tell you that after I give you what little I know, I'm going to turn it over to Rayanne, because my colleague Chad Gillis has looked at this, and I don't know that I've ever really written a story that has anything to do with back pumping. But I think that there's a misconception about back pumping, and my understanding, and Rayanne can correct me if I'm wrong, is that it does not happen very much, and that when it does, it's not for the convenience and economic benefit of the farmers, but it's as a flood control measure. At least that's what I think I've read, but I know Rayanne knows.
Yep, she's right. So that 2007, the governing board of the South Florida Water Management District basically outlawed the practice of back pumping, where the EAA the agricultural lands south of the lake, would use the lake as a convenient storage spot to pump, literally pump water uphill into the lake. That was also part of what brought U.S. Sugar to the table to talk about the sale of land. But there are the towns of Clewiston, South Bay, Belglade, and Pahokee that will experience flooding at about 13 feet 5 inches. And so only emergency back pumping to protect those communities is allowed today. That's different than back flowing. So what happened this year, there's a good example of how a design to back flow canals, so gravity, where until the lake hits 15, there are two canals that can flow back into the lake. That's the L8 on the other coast and the Clewiston Industrial Canal. And those routinely put water back into the lake. Once the lake hits 15, they go other places.
But they don't have to clean that stuff up before they put it in there?
No, that goes back to our best management practices. It's that presumption of compliance with water quality standards that they don't have that same restriction.
So what needs to happen to make these things cleaned up? I mean,
well, I think that
we all know how bad and gross it is, but what's it going to take to?
Well, we know what we do on golf courses and in communities that are urban developments. You've got to hold water. You've got to give it time to deposit sediments, to get contact with plant material where the nutrients will be taken up and the oils and greases will be trapped.
So that kind of
that takes time and space.
But that kind of answers a question that we had from one guy who said, why can't we just build a pipe and drain the lake down into the Everglades?
Because you'd get no treatment at all.
It would just be putting the same polluted water into the Everglades.
And creating a new point source. And the infrastructure,
I do know
the cost, yeah, O&M.
Sorry, Amy.
Sorry.
No, I was just going to say the other thing, too. People say, well, you just, you know, throw it into the Everglades. But there are, because the Everglades is overseen by the feds, there are standards. You cannot put dirty, polluted water into the Everglades. There's a certain threshold to which it must be clean and it must be okay to go into that federally overseen park, or you just can't do that.
And that's because it's naturally a very low nutrient system to begin with. So you change it from Everglades into cattails.
We have one quick question that I'm going to throw out to everybody if anybody knows the answer to this one. So I'm just kind of – it's kind of a Hail Mary pass, I guess, with a minute and a half left. Does anybody know if the fish is safe to eat or if it's unsafe? Do we know anything about our local fish?
Dr. Larry Brand last night was talking about with the red tide, he would not eat the fish. However, the tissue should be fine if you're taking all the organs out. Then you aren't going to be eating the parts that have the most concentration. But
and maybe definitely remove the skin.
Also different for the two. Remove the skin for sure. Red tide is not in the guts. Red tide is not as prone to build up in the tissue. The cyanobacteria, totally different. It will build up in the tissue. There are some articles I saw about how you cook it. Microwaving it had the most effect. I don't know if fish is any good after you microwave
gross.
It, but it sounds nasty.
Nobody wants you
but
to do that.
That was
in
about
the
only thing. Boiling, yeah. Things like that. There's still that's high concentrations terrible. Of those toxins in the meat of the fish.
Okay. All right. Well, that's all the time we have for our show today. I think we made it through about 3 pages of questions out of the 11. But I do want to thank my guest, Raeann Wessel, the National Resource Policy Director at the Sanibel Captiva Conservation Foundation, Amy Bennett-Williams, environmental reporter and storyteller at the News Press, Dr. Patrick Reedy from Florida Gulf Coast Ear, Nose, and Throat, and also Dr. Vince Lovko is staff scientist and program manager for the phytoplankton ecology system at Moat Marine Laboratory in Sarasota. Thank you all for joining me today. Our show today was produced by Mike and Ivory, myself, and our listeners. Our director is Richard Chin Kui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Julie Glenn. This is WGCU-FM Fort Myers, 90.1, WMKO Marco Island, 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.